So, this is Jim Swearingen from Kenner. He's designing the toys.
Should have been here yesterday. We blew up the Death Star.
Wow.
Well, you want to go check out the model? It's the smuggler ship.
And I'm like, oh my gosh. This is everything I was, this is what I wanted. Now I'm pumped to make the very first Star Wars toys.
1 month later, Star Wars opened and the world was changed forever. Now, unless you've been frozen in carbonite,
put Captain Solo in the cargo hold.
You know how big Star Wars is, but consider this.
The Star Wars films, 8, have roughly made $7 billion at the box office. The toys have made twice that amount.
That's $14 billion worth of childhood joy that helped shape generations of us fans.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. That was the opening scene in the first episode of the now 8-part Netflix documentary, The Toys That Made Us. What we learn from the series is that some toys capture the imagination of children. Others just don't hit the right note. And occasionally, a family of toys is so in touch with the culture, they become iconic and have a lasting influence on the imagination of adults. The Netflix documentary series opened last year with the story of Star Wars, the Star Wars toy line, which was created in Cincinnati by Kenner Toys and became an international phenomenon. A few weeks ago, Netflix released season 2 of The Toys That Made Us. This year, the series begins with stories of toys inspired by Star Trek. We are joined today by series creator and executive producer Brian Volkweis, the former senior product designer at Kenner Toys and principal conceptual designer for its line of Star Wars toys, Jim Swearingen, and the son of Kenner co-founder and former Kenner manager, Corky Steiner. If you can join us, call us by calling 513-419-7100, or you can email us at talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Welcome, everybody, to Cincinnati Edition. It's great to have you here today. So, Brian, I have a feeling that you grew up really loving toys. And so what were the toys that made you?
I mean, the main toy, and I think all kids grow up loving toys. Just some of us they keep loving them as we enter our 40s. And I mean, the main toy, the whole inspiration for even the series was Star Wars, and that was the Millennium Falcon for the 3/4 inch, and also the miniature diecast one were without a doubt the two most important toys to me growing up when I was a little kid. I took them everywhere. I mean, literally everywhere, to summer camp, you name it. I still have the diecast one. Unfortunately, the bigger one did not make it. Probably out of my single digits, but it was really Star Wars, and then a couple of I was a little into G.I. Joe, a little into Transformers, but Star Wars was pretty much the end all be all.
Consequently, the first segment of the first series, right there on Star Wars. Jim Swearingen, you were that designer. We heard an actor portraying you at the very beginning of that clip. You're very famous. And then we heard your voice. What's been the response to this next Netflix series for you personally? And has it connected you to a whole world of another aspect of this whole toy culture that maybe you never had been connected to?
Yeah, it's taken on a whole... I'm in a whole new world with collectors and stuff. There were a few that knew me. There were people writing books and stuff. But since Netflix, I'm an invited guest to... I'm doing 6 Comic-Cons this year and signing autographs and making presentations about the good old days of Star Wars. So it's a long time ago.
So what's Comic-Con like in terms of What kind of questions do people just want to ask you?
Well, the thing I hear most often is people coming up and say, I just have to tell you, you made my childhood such a great time. And I my response is usually, gosh, it makes me feel a little older. You know, I kind of feel like I'm part of it, but at the same time, it makes me feel, you know, when they say, oh, my dad played with your toys, it really puts me back because it was 40 years ago. So
right. Well, in fact, in Brian's case, I looked Brian's bio up. Brian's exactly the same age as my son. So I have that sense of how Star Wars toys came into probably Brian's life because of the same, you know, same age, and because they didn't get out there at the same time as the movies, and we can talk about that. Corky, how the heck did Kenner, a Cincinnati-based toy maker, find itself in the right place at the right time to on that train?
Certainly luck had something to do with it. Remember that a number of companies really passed up the opportunity to do the Star Wars toys. And when Kenner was shown early on concepts, we bought this concept based on almost nothing. There was no film developed. We had a fellow who's Jim Black and Jim Swearingen who came to Kenner Management, and they said, look, everything, and you've heard this before, everything in this product line is a toy. It's totally toyetic. And when Bernie
Toyetic, a technical term at Kenner, right?
Well, toyetic was a term that was coined at Kenner by Bernie Loomis, the then head of the company. And what really made the toy line, and I don't think this has ever been said before, let me interrupt myself. Usually, toy manufacturers shied away from anything that was movie-related because the movie was here today and gone tomorrow. Television series was one thing, but movies was something else. But Kenner decided to take a leap of faith, and they jumped on the bandwagon, and boy, what a ride it was won. It isn't a Conestoga wagon. It's a real, real rocket ship, if you would. And the byline of this is simply, not have you seen the movie Star Wars. The question is, how many times have you seen the movie? And when you hear word of mouth 1, 2, 5, 10, 15 times, and dads today talking to their kids, and on and on and on, and this was only one of three parts of a trilogy that now has spanned, let's see, 1977. Boy, knocking on the door of 50 years, that's something incredible.
Yeah. And when that first movie came out, the toys weren't ready to go because they had been so slow about getting to Kenner and getting a deal done. There weren't any toys to get out on the market right away.
Well, that's a more than interesting story. The timing of the introduction of the movie was totally out of sync to the manufacturing time, and the only thing that could be marketed was, quote, paper product, so that you could get magazines and so forth, puzzles and that. So in the first year, there were no actual toys. In the second year, that completely changed, and the toys appeared on the shelf. But I'm surprised, Brian, in your love of toys, that you talked about everything but the lightsaber. And boy, those lightsaber fights and action scenes were something else. I'll bet you just overlooked that.
You know, I know you're joking, and it's funny, but we didn't overlook it. The first cut of the Star Wars episode was about 2.5 hours long, and it was very, very painful having to cut so much, to put it mildly. The good news is, and this is actually, I think, the first time I'm saying this publicly, we are beginning work on a DVD and Blu-ray that will contain a lot of the stuff we cut. So you will see those lightsabers, Corky.
Well, before we move on to the beginning of the second season, which I want to do, we have a call already from Don. And Don, actually, I think, wants to talk most directly to Corky because I think there's a connection here. Don?
Yes, this is Don Erb 2, Mr. Steiner.
I have a grin from ear to ear.
It's good talking to you. So I'm getting a little emotional because it's been a long time, but I missed the last one of the last times you were on WBXU. I listened to them quite a bit, but it's good to hear your voice and to let you know that my brother and I are still around. Unfortunately, I don't know what my son did with all of his toys.
There's a sin.
I remember a Millennium Falcon that was always flying around my house back in the day.
Well,
anyway, go ahead.
Well, people who are toy collectors, and Jim Swearingen can do a much better job on this than I can, and I'll just take one small example. At one point in time, Kenner introduced coins into the Star Wars figures package, and those coins were very inexpensive coins, and they now today can be worth between 5 cents and $500 per coin, depending on the collector's coins.
Wow! So, anyway, it sounds like there's a lot of connection, a lot of emotion here. We're going to have to take a break in a minute, but Brian, just to set this up, the first season opened with the story of Star Wars toys and Kenner. The second season opened with toys inspired by Star Trek, and Star Trek, the TV series, actually predates Star Wars. So these are two really different stories, though, right? You can want to just set that up for us a little bit?
Well, one of the reasons I was attracted to the Star Trek story was because it was the polar opposite of Star Wars, where George Lucas had the political power and Kenner had the deal, black and white in writing, to have absolute control over everything in a very systematic and high-quality way. Star Trek was the opposite, in that Roddenberry, for legal reasons, did not have the political power that George Lucas did, and Paramount and CBS were also divided up into two different companies, which also worked against it, and that created literally the opposite paradigm for Star Trek that Star Wars enjoyed in terms of its consistency and high quality. The thing which was interesting, and we put this in the Star Trek episode, one of the first things Lucas did after he realized that not only was Star Wars a hit, but it was a massive hit, was he spoke to Gene Roddenberry. And this was something, I've been a fan of Star Wars and Star Trek my whole life. I had never heard this before. He called Roddenberry and got advice as to what he should do. And Roddenberry basically gave him a list of what not to do, which is what happened to Roddenberry.
Yeah, very interesting.
And that's pretty much the way the episode takes off. It's a much more humorous. It's probably one of the funniest episodes we did so far. Was just the trials and tribulations of the Star Trek toys.
It wasn't just the characters in Star Wars or Star Trek that captured the imaginations of children. It was also their spaceships, translating the Millennium Falcon, the Death Star, the Starship Enterprise into toys were critical and a challenge. We are joined today by the creator and executive producer of The Toys That Made Us, Brian Volkweis, the former senior product designer of Kenner Toys, Jim Swearingen, and the son of Kenner co-founder and former Kenner manager, Corky Steiner. To join our discussion, call 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. And Jim and Corky, you were in this area when both the toys of both Star Trek and Star Wars were out in the market. And as Brian was telling us just before the break, the Star Trek toys were all over the place. They weren't standardized. What was the conversation that was going on inside your shop about that, Jim?
Well, I think when we first read the script and got to get started, it really was evident that George Lucas was going to keep a tight rein on everything. So it was, we'd seen Star Trek. I mean, I grew up with Star Trek kind of through my college years. And we were really in close collaboration with Lucasfilm just because they wanted it. They wanted to be authentic. They wanted it to really put kids right into the world. When I first read it, the first thing that stood out to me were the fight scenes, the X-Wings and TIE fighters that were described. And at that point, we were just looking at a couple of pictures of ships, but the pirate, you know, Han Solo, the pirate and his ship and all the X-Wing and stuff, that was where the core was. The difference that I saw with it and Star Trek was, it was kind of the world after Star Trek, because Star Trek was a lot of diplomacy and where, you know, the prime directive and all was central to the storyline. This was after that, when the bad guys were taken over.
And it was somewhat, Star Trek was also somewhat headier than yes. Star Wars.
Cerebral,
yeah. I mean, you can't have Spock when not having sort of a cerebral show.
Yeah.
And consequently, the markets are different for the toys, right? I mean, who wanted those toys and how big the market was?
Yeah, I think, Star Wars started out with the kids' market, and we really aimed at the toyetic part of it being the play part of it. Star Trek went at it from a different point of view, and they had more, they really were pushed after the TV show ended in 69, they were pushed by the fans and people that wanted to collect stuff. So it went from a different thing. Now Star Trek has kind of flipped over. Star Wars is now driven by collectors who were the kids that played with the toys. Now they're collectors or they're putting their kids into it. So they've kind of reversed roles.
Go ahead, Brian.
Sorry.
No, go ahead.
Well, I mean, one of the interesting things to point out is Star Trek, as of even 2 weeks ago, is still having issues or growth, even though it's over 50 years, growing pains. McFarlane Toys, which is one of the most respected toy companies in the world, just announced that a Star Trek phaser based on Discovery is not happening. That was, you know, physical designs and hard copies have already been seen. I believe the factories were even starting to make them, and they just announced that they're being pulled. So it continues up until as of even 2 weeks ago, this incredibly different path from that which the Star Wars toys has taken.
Yeah, and the two episodes really lay that out nicely. Corky, you know, Kenner had other toys that predated and postdated what you were doing with Star Wars, and some of them, Easy Bake Oven, Play-Doh, Spirograph, I mean, all these things. What did Star Wars do to the company when you got into this and you said you sort of, it was a rocket ride? What did it do to the company?
Kenner was founded by three brothers, Al, Phil, and Joe Steiner. Each of them had interacting roles, and it was a family-held company, and as Kenner grew, most of the ideas of Kenner were internal generated ideas based on things that you saw in everyday life. A pre-television thing, television advertising, give a show projector, and so forth. And if you fast forward to the $6 million man, that was one of the major lines that put us, major shows that put us on the map, followed by the Easy Bake Oven, which is an internally generated idea. You could bake pies, cakes, and cookies in 6 to 16 minutes. And the Easy Bake Oven, and then the acquisition by General Mills and the integration of Play-Doh. And then in 1976, and then in 1977, as you said, Kenner signed a contract with Lucasfilm. Nobody really knew exactly what was going to happen. And the toy buyers were reluctant because it was a movie-based property and only television properties were involved. And Star Wars really set the table for the entrance of licensed properties into the Kenner theme and marketing strategy. And literally, it was a rocket ship taking off. And just to draw on something else, when you're talking about vehicles and you talk about the Millennium Falcon, it's a very, very interesting story that one designer, Mark Boudreau, who had an involvement as a student in school, was on the project with Kenner, and believe it or not, today is still designing and is an integral part of the Hasbro team designing and producing the Millennium Falcon.
Wow.
So basically, the force has clearly been with Kenner.
There you go. Jim, these started out as movies or TV shows, depending on which one you're talking about. What is it in your mind that toys do that adds to, that makes this a really different experience for viewers, but especially for children?
Well, I think the toys, especially the action figures and stuff, let kids actually play out what they see on the screen. You know, and you can build a world around it. So I know, I grew up with Roy Rogers and my stagecoach, and it's the same kind of play. We played for hours just recreating things that we might have seen on television and then branching off of that. So the action figure, it's that area really is just recreation of all the things. And then the lightsabers and the pistols and stuff that have come out of it are all part of the play. It really is the toyetic part. It's taking what's created on the screen and turning it into a toy world for yourself.
If I could add a postscript to that, toys today are really somewhat static. And when you take an action figure and that youngster or youngsters can be creative and fashion their own ideas and patterns and play patterns, you really have something that's lasting. That probably is one of the reasons for the longevity of the toy line, whether it's vehicles or figures.
Okay. Brian, I mean, the title of your series is The Toys That Made Us. What are the values? What are the worldviews? And maybe we can get Jim, who's been going to Comic-Con, has become a new star at Comic-Con. What are the values? What's the worldview of the generation that grew up with these toys? How is that generation shaped by these toys?
I think that within reason, I have three very small children. My oldest child is four. So I'm very curious to watch my children grow and see what their relationship is with toys, over the next 10 to 20 years. But just watching my daughter, who, like I said, is, she's actually about four and a half now, a lot of people I see online all the time, a lot of people are like, today's toys suck, today's suck. And first of all, I don't agree with that. Second of all, I think that every generation can truthfully say, going back 500 years to when kids were playing with, wooden figures nailed together with, iron screws or whatever, they're the toys that made us, because they gave you the imagination, they gave you the tools for your imagination to physically manifest itself. So, I remember when I was little, there were a whole bunch of Star Wars vehicles that were not made, and I used to make them out of Legos. And, of course, they looked nothing like their real-world counterparts, but they absolutely, in my mind, looked like their real-world counterpart. Not that any of the Star Wars vehicles were real-world, but you know what I mean.
Yeah. So
that's what toys do.
Jim.
And I would say that was true for my 4.5-year-old as it was for me when I was 4.5, and it's always true.
Brian, one question. You've got two seasons out there on Netflix right now.
And I am so sorry. I had a and I, if this was not told to you, I apologize. I had a very hard out at 10:30, and unfortunately, okay. I do have to jump.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much for being with us.
10:30 sharp, so I apologize very much. Jim, Corky, very good to hear your voices, and I hope you've been well, and I hope to see you again very soon.
Very good. Thank you. Jim, what's your next Comic-Con appearance and where?
I'm going to be Atlanta. That's my next one. I think it's the 4th, 5th, and 6th. I'm doing Atlanta, Detroit, Mexico City, and Nashville over the next couple months. Your question
Mexico
about—
Mexico City, okay.
Yeah, I've done that twice. This will be my second time in Mexico City. Your question about how these toys work— What I've seen at Comic-Cons is you see families where there's a grandfather, a son, and a grandson or granddaughter, where it's multi-generational. Whether it's Star Wars or Star Trek or their favorite game, people dress up. The whole family comes. So in some cases, it brings families together because they can play through, they can watch the movie, they can play through the stuff, and they can relate generationally. So I think it's... You know, the play goes, you know, from generation to generation, as they say.
Well, we're out of time. I do want to make the point that The Toys That Made Us are an ongoing series on Netflix. Season 3, Brian was telling us, was in production now and maybe is going to appear sometime between December and March, not quite sure when. And then there's a 4th series also in production. So this is an ongoing thing and people who want to watch and can just plunge in for themselves. So I want to thank all of my guests, Brian Volk-Weiss, Jim Swearingen, and Corky Steiner. Thanks for listening to this podcast of Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Archives of our programs are available on the website wvxu.org. I'm Dan Hurley.